I'm a bit curious about the role of constitutionalism here, just to piggyback on what Kalundi had asked. For a long time, there was the idea that was pushed for lots of countries, especially after the end of the Cold War, that by changing constitutions that you're going to fix many of the problems that are there with both the state and with the elections. Is it your view, given the Tanzanian experience, that this is something that is tenable, that something that can happen?
Sorry, are you asking me or you're asking Kalundi?
Yes, I'm asking you for that.
So look, the Constitution, it's all well and good to change the Constitution, but if you don't have civic education on the Constitution itself and the meaning of the Constitution, and you don't have the general public, the population buying into it and understanding it and demanding the adherence to the Constitution, then you might as well not have a constitution. And it you can, I think you can create changes by through constitutional amendments and particularly a very well thought out and strong constitution. But you need people to be aware of it. You need defenders of the constitution. And the defenders of the constitution have to be the people themselves. Let's make this clear. I think we need to be clear about one thing. Once you hand over power to people, to a select group of people, frankly speaking, they rarely want to defend the people. They will want to defend their power. And they rarely want to defend the constitution. They want to maintain power. And we've seen this in Kenya, for example. I mean, you're going into another crisis now. Despite the amount of work you went through with respect to your new constitution. So it's really important that the people buy into the constitution and they are aware that they are the defenders of the Constitution, and they don't expect only politicians or the judiciary to or parliament to defend the Constitution.
Thanks for that. You're completely right about Kenya and our 25-year fight for a new constitution that does not seem to have bred legitimate elections, if you will, or elections that everybody believes are not being stolen. I don't know, Omari, may I ask about the constitution and Somalia? Kalundi, I'll come back to you immediately after this. I mean, there has been a progress from when you had the transition of federal charter to the provisional constitution, etc. Has that made you think the state more legitimate and its processes, its elections, are more legitimate in the eyes of Somalians?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think we're ju there just yet in the Somali case because the constitution is still provisional, and that honestly, I mean, it's not very clear in certain areas, and it's even contradictory in other areas. So, for example, even just a few years ago, there's this constant tension between the federal government and the member states in the Somali context. When it came down to some issues around foreign affairs and whatnot, the federal government was pointing to one article of the Constitution, and the member states were pointing to another. And, in some sense, they're both right, if you go strictly by the articles. So I think there's a lot of contradictions in the provisional Constitution that do need to be finalized and do need to be addressed in order for that to be a bit more legitimate. But I think I'd piggyback on a little bit of what Fatima said, and there's two sort of factors beyond just creating, a great document on paper that I think you'd have to have in the Somali context and probably any context, really, for that to be successful. We shouldn't view the constitution itself just as a panacea. But first of all, of course, you need the institutions around it. So right now, there's no constitutional court in Somalia. So there's no way to regulate any of these disputes. Right now, the government says its mandate can continue based on the passage of some parliamentary legislation last fall. Well, the opposition says that parliamentary legislation violates the constitution. And so you just have both word against each other. There's no way to address that. There's no court to turn to. There's no process behind that. So, even if you had a clear constitution, you still have these disputes that arise. So you need the institutions around it. And then secondly, I think you need that culture of constitutionalism, because that's not really there in this context either. Maybe it's there in a different way. in terms of kind of cherry picking the constitution when it benefits you and then it dismissing it at other times. So politicians or other groups, you know, will point to part of the constitution, you know, when it benefits them this particular circumstance, and then, you know, when they're doing something that violates it, completely ignore it. The constitution doesn't matter. It's still provisional and you dismiss it. And so we see that quite a bit as well. So I think that culture of constitutionalism also needs to kind of get there. You know, that's something that I think happens a bit over time. It's been a long process. It's probably gone on longer than people had wanted. You know, the fact that the provisional constitution is still not finalized, is that key marker. But I'd say even once you get that finalized, that development's going to continue, and those other institutions need to accompany it to really make it useful.
Yeah, I think just a quick follow-up, if I may put you a bit on the spot. Would you say Formaggio at the moment is in power in a constitutional way? I mean, didn't his mandate run out sometime in February? What do you think? What's the scenario there?
You're going to turn me into a lawyer here. But I mean, based on the Constitution, the government was given a four-year term. And so that term then ended February 8th. If we accept that Parliament can extend the term indefinitely, or we accept the parliamentary legislation from last fall, basically means accepting indefinite extensions, because there's no time-bound process. You know, the only time-bound eventual idea is that an election has to happen. Well, the government's also in charge of organizing that election. So you have a perverse sort of incentive to delay that process as well. So, you know, I think the problem is that, yes, this has happened before in the past, and it wasn't an issue because there was elite agreement around it. Elite agreement that even violated the Constitution. From a strict constitutional point, it still violated that. But at least there was some elite consensus. So it kind of mitigated a bit of the issue. That's what's different now. So I think unless you get to that elite consensus around Formaggio's mandate, then yeah, it's absolutely a question. And Somalia is in a bit of a limbo because some people will accept that and some won't. So yeah, in the absence of, unfortunately, a court or something to reconcile this, it comes down to elite consensus, which just isn't there.
Okay, Kalundi, you're going to say something for brought in Omar?
Oh yes, I was, thank you. Oh, by the way, it's important for me that my children believe me when I say that there are people out there who take me seriously. So that's why I brought them in as witnesses in an actual meeting. Now, the first point is that I think we have to recognize that a country like Uganda literally needs about five people to run it at national management level. You just need the head of security, someone to resolve disputes, someone to count the money, someone to organize production, and someone to train human labor. That is it. Everything else that has come subsequent to when Uganda was created in 1989 has been concessions to largely, I would say, in fact, middle-class demands, or concessions to popular demands, which are then handed to the middle class. Because even democracy itself, I don't understand. I know for a fact that certain cultures, especially there in the Horn, like among the Afar, among a lot of Somali clans, and certainly among Oromo people, there is a huge tradition of democracy, okay, at community level. I know in the Afar, like even young children have the right to speak in communal meetings. Why is it that when now you have this state structure, the culture is completely opposite and cannot be changed to reflect actually the way a lot of the people are? I mean, Oromo people are electing new leaders, or used to traditionally every 8 years, actual elections. And they have an actual court system that is native, as we do here in Uganda. That's the first point. So when you talk about the constitution, you have to understand it in that context that, in my view, the constitutions were not created or designed to solve a state problem in terms of creating greater accessibility. The Ugandan constitution is actually a watering hole. That is literally what it is. It was designed to bring into the fold of the state as many political actors as possible, and then simply tranquilize them with jobs and appointments and big salaries and what have you. Because every single coup in Uganda from independence up to now, every single armed rebellion, every single political crisis has been led by the politically active middle class in Uganda. And incidentally, every single coup or attempted coup or or invasion or whatever in Uganda has taken place in what was supposed to be an election year. A lot of people don't know this. Talk about 1966 of Obote and Mutesa, you talk about Amin in 1971, talk about the attempted coup against Amin in 1974, talk about the fall of Amin in 79 and the rise of Obote in 1980. You talk about the coup against Obote in 1985 and the emergence of Museveni in 86. All those were election years. So there's an actual link between the failure to have an actual election, because the purpose of the constitution is not to allow an exchange of the currents of political, you know, discourse. It's to give everybody something to make them shut up this time around, okay? So once you say there's going to be election, as Fatma has completely correctly put it, and I really love that point, and as I've said in the comments, I'm going to steal it. Once you say there is going to be an election, you actually trigger a crisis, because everyone now has to start maneuvering to see how do I actually retain this power, or how do I get the power off the other person? But none of those considerations are legal or constitutional ones. So the first victim of an election is the democratic process. The first victim of an election is the constitutional process. So I go back to my point, until we recognize that we still have communities with community concerns, especially with neoliberalism, there's been a huge amount of land grabbing all over the region, because they want to turn this entire region all the way up the Nile Valley and between the two rift valleys. Is supposed to be a giant wheat, rice, soya, and other grain farm. That's actually what's happening. And the presidents of all the different states in this region know that that is the program. And some are with it, some are neutral, some will deal with it when it comes. So from the beginning, ab initio, the concerns, the objective concerns of communities are not part of the concerns of the state. So you're going to have a crisis. That is all I wanted to add to the point. I think I should stop there. But I wanted to really thank Fatma for the point she made. It's really cleared up a lot of thinking in my own mind. That's it.
Okay. Adam, if we may come to you. As you look at this issue of whether our states, including Ethiopia, are configured to provide or produce democracy and elections. Perhaps you could also think about how the internet and the connection that it creates between people has any effect on this, and whether it's changing this or enabling people to tackle or even challenge the structures of coloniality that many of us have been struggling against. What do you think?
Naturally, the way we communicate, the way we set the agenda has shifted. There's no one center of gravity anymore in terms of setting the agenda, in terms of shaping people's thoughts. And the fact that, you know, in the old days, there were organized professional media that mediate, that distill information and control the narratives. That doesn't happen anymore. So anybody with proper internet and a computer can set the agenda with the required skills. So in that sense, particularly around times of elections, when the attitude or the aptitude for participation, for engagement is significant, right? It has serious implications. And as I said in the beginning, in relation to Ethiopia, the elections are still three months to go. But the narratives have been going on, and that already affects people's identities, people's thinking, people's perceptions about what the election is going to look like. And of course, you know, with you cannot work with the same mentality as in the you know 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And unfortunately, you know, the idea that people are often looking for information that strengthens rather than challenge their thoughts, their ideas, means that our politics has become even more complicated. It has become even more volatile. And if I may add something to what Fatma and Kalundi said, I think democracy fundamentally is about policies, right? But in a lot of our countries, the problems, you know, if you put all the political groups together, the ideas, at least in terms of the strategy, the tools, they are very similar. So the competition often is about either identity, or if it's within the same group, it's about character and capacity, right? It's really not about, it's not a competition over ideas, It's competition about identity, over character, who can do it better, who can do it with more integrity. These are really the questions rather than about policies. And that's partly because we have not, as my colleague said, we have not created a system where the political process is not distinct from, for instance, the bureaucracy, right? The part that delivers services, that is supposed to be a machine, which serves everybody. Our politics is actually happening more often in the bureaucracy rather than in parliament and in the council of ministers, right? And because of that lack of distinction, and because as I said initially, the media, the center of, because of the social media, there's no center of gravity, there's no one organ that controls things. It creates even multiple problems. Every little grievance becomes an identity issue or a political issue. And that obviously complicates the situation even more than what we're used to in 20, 30 years ago.
Right, but if I may just follow up on that in terms of our creating new circumstances or new things and a politics of ideas. I know Ethiopia has had a few reforms in terms of registering political parties and who can register political parties and what's expected of them. Kenya has tried the same, but this doesn't seem to change much, at least in our case. So my question again is, what is, do you think is the role of political parties here, or should we be rethinking the entire architecture that we are trying to reframe our politics to look like what happens in the West? But maybe what we need to be doing is to try something different. What do you think?
If you look at the origins of democracy, political parties were actually not there. Democracy created political parties, not the other way around. In the US, when they drafted the constitution, there were no political parties. It was largely individual groups. And in fact, part of the way the constitutions are designed with checks and balances, they are intended to prevent particular factions from taking control and all of that. So parties are creations of democracy and not the other way around. So the question is, how can we make them fit for purpose? But I think at this stage, today, it's impossible, because our countries are large, we are complex. So you need organizations that collate ideas, that bring people with similar conceptions together, and then outline their policy ideas and how they do. So we need them. I think we cannot do without them. But of course, as I said, the problem is that political organization is not fundamentally based on policies, right? So how can we encourage, and then that's a million-dollar question, how can we encourage political groups to organize along policy rather than along identity and other other less significant issues? That's very difficult. And of course, the main challenge is I think I don't know if it was Kalundi or Fatma said, our politics are completely winner takes all, right? Whoever wins comes to power and they get everything, right? And that's what they tried to do in 2010 in Kenya. They tried to address some of those challenges, but of course it hasn't, if the intention was to make the presidency less interesting in Kenya, it hasn't worked, right? But it doesn't mean that the change didn't, the reforms didn't bring about change. You have 47 counties where, some people can rule, they can set ideas, implement policies on the ground close to their people. And it's a work in progress. And I think that's also one thing we should always recognize. It's very difficult, but it's, you cannot abandon it. You just have to look for ways to improve it. And then I think another thing is, obviously we are always against incumbents, but I think we need to recognize incumbents sometimes as well. I mean, I don't think incumbents are only self-interested. All they want to do is, govern the country, empty the country and all of that. I think we need to also, as opposition, as civil society, we need to recognize the legitimacy of some of the ideas that these people have. And I think often the clash, every idea, every contestation essentially grows into a clash. And once you attack, once the government feels threatened, they also start pushing back, right? So I'm not saying we shouldn't challenge them. I think we must. That's the entire idea. But at the same time, we should not picture incumbents as these greedy monsters out there to get us, right? We need to recognize the governments as much as we want the governments to recognize the opposition, right? So we need to start from that recognition that the other person, their ideas, their policies, even if you disagree with them, they are legitimate, that they have concerns. And that can hopefully then lead to some kind of civility, you know, mutual recognition. But if everything is drawn, you know, if everything is about drawing lines and one out to eliminate the other one, I think we'll just be going down the rabbit hole.
Kalundi, yeah, go ahead.
Could Adam name just one single political figure in this entire region who is currently in office legitimately among the presidents?
No, I was not saying that they are legitimate as such. What I was saying that we need to recognize that they have ideas, that they have constituencies, that they have support bases. They may have created it through unholy means, right? But we cannot dismiss that our leaders have absolutely no constituency, right? Even if there was a democratic election, a completely free and fair election, I am sure they will have some good support, right? They may not win, but they have some good support. So what I'm trying to do at here is not to support them. We shouldn't, right? But we should recognize that they have ideas and constituencies that they represent, and often they recognize as legitimate themselves, right? So if you reject the legitimacy, the natural thing that they will do is also reject you and attack you. And we have to also acknowledge that they have the balance of weapons, right? They, you know, if you want to engage
them. I'm still waiting for a name.
I think if I may just jump in here, I think Fatma, you want to add something to this?
Yes, I do. I think, Adam, you are placing the responsibility of recognition on the weaker parties. You're asking people who the opposition have no, they don't have any power whatsoever. They only have a constituency. They don't have the army. They don't have control of the judiciary like the ruling party. They don't have control of parliament like the ruling party. You're asking them to recognize somehow we're going to get peace if they recognize the legitimacy of a ruling party. I think, in my view, and to recognize that the ruling party has a constituency. Well, they have no choice but to recognize that the ruling party has a constituency. I think that we have to ask ruling parties, and that is the point of democracy. We have to ask ruling parties to recognize the legitimacy of the opposition, that the opposition do have a constituency. And this constituency, although the ruling party may decide that this constituency is small, it might be 20%, it might be 30%, but it is still a constituency. And that the opposition do have legitimate ideas, and they can contribute to the development of a country. And the whole concept of democracy is to listen to the people who have lost. Because let's accept it, if the ruling parties who win by hook or by crook or by whatever means sat down with the opposition and said, listen, we're prepared to listen to your ideas and we're prepared to give you a voice, do you think the opposition would say no? Is that really going to happen? I doubt it. I mean, you know, let's be honest, we're putting pressure. There's something that I find intolerable. It is all, we put pressure on the underdog, that it is the underdog that always has to keep kowtowing to the people who are running the state, who have all the power, and they have to recognize them. These people are recognized by everybody, including the international community, by the way.
It's a form of abuse.
I mean, I get what Fatma is saying. I think it's a good point that she makes about the burden being on the incumbents. But if I come to you, Adam, to perhaps clarify or explain what your point is, But Omar, in terms of how we deal with incumbents, I mean, in Somalia, we've seen them hand over power, you know, fairly, you know, peacefully and stuff. So do you think the rest of us have it wrong about how we approach our relationship and how we deal with our incumbency?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, every context here is a little different. So I think one of the fundamental differences in the Somali context is how fractious the politics is and how the state institutions are not really centralized in a manner in which they can exert control over the rest of the country, really. You know, whether that's, you know, looking at the reality just from a security standpoint, Somali security is still underwritten by the international community, whether that's, you know, you're looking at to where the federal government actually exerts control outside of Mogadishu and some of the federal member states, which are quite autonomous. So, you know, while I think one of the goals of the Farmajo presidency was actually maybe to become more like some of these other contexts in which things are a bit more centralized within Mogadishu and within the federal government. And there's been some new tools and some new support that have come through during his tenure that have aided in that pursuit. But I still think, you know, what we're looking at right now is the central failure to completely centralize the Somali system. So if you look at the federal member states, which are opposed or aligned to Mogadishu right now, you know, the ones that are aligned with Mogadishu are ones where the federal government was able to get candidates aligned to them elected. So the two that are most opposed are the Jubaland and the Puntland, areas where the federal government was not able to exert its authority and its reach. And so we're seeing that fundamental battle right going on right there, that the state just really isn't powerful enough to centralize. And I think that's the central lesson from the past few years, that in the Somali context, I mean, it's too fractious to be able to sort of carry that sort of central power. The history is also there under the military dictatorship of central power, which didn't go so well. And so you see constantly new leaders come in, but it's hard to satisfy the exact same constituencies they satisfied 4 years ago in order to get their reelection. And you can chalk that up to the clan politics. You can chalk that up to the lack of state power around that. You can chalk it up to, honestly, a lot of the wounds of the civil war of the 90s haven't really been healed. So I think just that we don't even have that option so much in that context.
Dem, are you still there with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Right.
Change your spot.
I don't know that you wanted to respond to any of this before we go to questions from the audience.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, good point. So, you know, just to explain, I don't want to sound like an apologist for authorities. So the fundamental point that I was trying to make is that you cannot have a democracy without mutual recognition, right? And naturally, the principal burden is on those who hold power, right? They have more power and therefore more responsibility in building and in enabling the situation. But at the same time, we cannot simply assume that those in the opposition are the ones with legitimate ideas, right? So we need to recognize, and I think this is very important, partly because, as you know, we have seen places where the opposition have come to power and done exactly the same thing as the previous incumbents, right? So we cannot let opposition groups lose or free, essentially, just because they are the opposition. So the fundamentally, just to clarify, I agree with both Kalundi and Fatima that the responsibility is on those in power. Obviously, they are also the ones with the most to lose if democracy works, because they will at least be they will at least risk losing power, right? If they don't lose it. So the most they lose is on them. But at the same time, we cannot just simply dismiss them as corrupt. And they, you know, and of course there are some, right? There's no question about that. But if you completely dismiss our leaders as greedy, all they think about is oppressing us and robbing us, I don't think will make much difference. And of course, the more we accuse them of that, they will push back. So we should accept that they will push back as well.
Right. So I think I'll just leave it at that. I'm sure there's points that some agree or disagree with.
When he shifted position, I thought he was also going to change his mind. But he shifted position and saying the same thing. You cannot tell people to start negotiating with people who are oppressing them. This is actually a form of abuse of human beings. You cannot tell people that. Okay. I am still at Asasa Nangojea Jina. Let him name one.
I think Kalundi made your point.
In the region today, who is there legitimately?
Kalundi, to be honest, I think
you cannot have legitimate ideas if you're in office illegitimately. Ideas democratically if you're in an undemocratic arrangement relationship. We have heard from Somalia, from Tanzania, from Zanzibar, everywhere. All the presidents are not there by legitimate means. He has failed to name even one.
I don't think his point was that they are legitimately in power, and I think he said that. And you do make your point that negotiation with people who are brutalizing you, in essence, isn't going to get you too far. But if I may, Adam, because I don't want us to get simply stuck in this, and I want to get in some questions from our audience. There's Wanjiko who asked about the gender-differentiated challenges that we have within elections, and in essence, the inability, but the challenges that women face within our societies in getting to the top tiers when it comes to elections. So I'm going to ask you, Fatma, not just because you're a woman, but because obviously in Tanzania, we now have a female president, head of state, who was a vice president, who seems to have made her way up to the top. So what do you think? Do you think it is easier for women nowadays to get up to the to higher, whatever, positions of power than it was before? You need to unmute your mic.
Thank you. I think I want to remind everybody how she got to the position of power. it was through the death of a man. Okay, there has never been a president, a female president in Southern Africa who has become president other than through the death of a man. Joyce Banda became president because a man died and she was a one-term president. There was a president of Burundi who became a female president in 1993-94, who became president after the death of a president. And we now have Samia Suluhu Hassan, who's become president after the death of a male president. Now, what I would like to see is her running in 2025. Then I could say the grand old party, CCM, was not just playing the narrative of let's put a woman in a position of power. Look, when you put a woman as a vice president, I don't believe they actually ever believed in the wildest dream that Magufuli would drop dead. I don't, during his presidency, I don't believe that. If they had known, or if someone, God had come down and said to them, Magufuli might drop dead or would drop dead in the middle of his presidency, second term, or the beginning of his second term, that makes it even worse for them, actually, because a woman gets to run the country for a lot longer than anticipated. You know, if they'd thought that, I'm sure they'd put a man. They would have put a man. But let me answer. There's a question here which someone has asked. Would the system undermine the powers of new Tanzanian presidents since she's a woman, Muslim, and from Zanzibar? I think the system will not undermine her. It's the men who surround her she has to watch, because they want the presidency in 2025. And they will do everything within their power to undermine her. So in my view, and the fact that she's a Muslim, that's really neither here nor there, because we don't have in Tanzania we're sort of 50-50, 50% Muslim, 50% Christian. And we've always had a system of presidencies within the CCM where, you know, it moves from the Christian community to the Muslim community. We have a Christian president and then a Muslim president. So the fact that she's a Muslim is not as important as the fact that she's a woman. And will they be able to tolerate a woman in 2025? I don't know. We'll wait and see. But I definitely can see them planning to put a man in, because it's a patriarchal society, absolutely patriarchal. And they have no intentions of letting a woman run the country for 10 years. I'm sure of that. We'll be right back.